session, and the last one before lunch is the always exciting lightning talk session. We actually have two of those today. We have one this morning and one later this afternoon. Rotan Hanrahan was going to be moderating the session, but he couldn't make it today. He had some emergency back at work, and therefore I'm pleased to have Matt Womer from W3C's team, who was actually working with Rotan, to call through the many, many good proposals that they received for lightning talks, and to he'll be moderating this for us today. And Matt?
Hi, so the lightning talks today, we've got a little bit of a new thing we're gonna try out. We're voting on a wild card session. The second session will have the last presentation will be voted on by online poll, the link to which is in the information for the TPAC channel on IRC. And depending on who wins that, that'll determine who has the last set of presentations. I'm just gonna get the video set up, and we'll start with TV, actually. Oh, sorry, TV, here. The video is not up yet, actually.
So let's. So I have a mic. Somebody up there hopefully will flip slides for me, and it's a short talk, so hopefully we won't get too far out of sync. So my the title for this talk sort of came up because when we were organizing with the way, you know, in the program committee for the thing, the question came up, what does the view from the outside in look like? And someone told me, you're not qualified because you've been doing things in the W3C for too long. So I made it a lightning talk. So my slides aren't up yet. Okay, I'll hang on, yeah. Look, I'm holding on to the mic. You'll have to like do something to get rid of me. So. So tell me when the title slide is up.
Something's happening.
Yeah, motion.
All right. So the goal then is to define what.
It's coming.
So I guess it's gone from the real world to the imaginary world. Go. Okay. So the goal then is to define what makes standards succeed and what is the touchstone for testing whether a standard has succeeded. So go to my next slide. So that's really the question I'd like to ask. What are the necessary... What's going on?
Hold on. Sorry.
The slides aren't that important. I usually make my slides sufficiently lightweight so that I have some value to add. So. So let me know what you want to do. I mean, if you're still fiddling with the slides, you know, that'll probably distract the audience more than.
Yes.
Okay. Sure. So now we have the title slide up?
Yeah.
Okay. So flip to my next slide. So the question then I...
Sorry, Joel?
Yes. So basically, the question to ask is, what are the necessary and sufficient conditions that you need to fulfill for a standard to succeed? And flip to my next slide. So we talk, if you sort of are going to measure somebody up for success, you need to define success. As we've heard throughout the day and on the IRC channel, everybody's been pointing out that everybody lives in their own world and calls it real. So I'd better define my measure of success. So I don't believe success in the standards process means exiting W3C process. That's bogus. That's not a measure of success. Success also to me means more than the thing that you do being adopted by just your target. Clearly, that is a necessary condition that your target community adopt it, but that's not a sufficient condition. And things that I will call out as real successes go way beyond their target community. So flip to my next slide. So this slide sort of lists what I call out and out successes. HTTP is an out and out success. I think HTTP was very successful because it was a very simple spec, a very simple protocol. And fortunately, it got well implemented. HTML has had a problem because it was never well implemented. You can sort of see HTTP was extremely successful because not only was it adopted and did its work, but other things. Let's get rid of the slides, guys. It's too distracting. So HTTP was extremely successful because a lot of things that people never imagined could be built were built on top of HTTP. In fact, 10 years later, people were able to do things like Atom and Atom Publishing Protocol on top of HTTP with relatively little pain. People were able to do web dev on top of HTTP with relatively little pain. And I think that's a mark on and a measure of success. So I would give HTTP, I would sort of hold HTTP up as the gold standard for doing standards right. So I sort of give things like CSS and XPath a passing grade. So both CSS and XPath have seen adoption within the community, but people have also been able to build other things out of both of them. I don't hold them to the same level as HTTP because CSS has had a lot of adoption pains, has had a lot of interoperability problems, and that has actually hurt all of us. I mean, CSS is a wonderful technology when it works well. XPath is very interesting. It came out of the XSLT world and has seen huge amount of traction with respect to where it lives. I mean, in fact, every AJAX JavaScript author still uses XPath to basically crawl over the DOM. And that, I think, is a huge measure.
Yes?
Measure of its success. Things that I call sort of questionable are things like XML schema. That's a technology I wouldn't inflict on my worst enemy. the whole web services stack. All of those things have this property that they work only for the target for which they were built. And that's clearly not a complete out-and-out failure. You can sort of say, this was my goal, it meets my goal, go away. That's fine. But then that sort of remains in a very tight vertical community and doesn't necessarily lead to people building on that complicated piece for the next level. So my final takeaways then are, don't define success in the standards process by exiting the W3C process. That's not a measure of success. Standards that work are ones that allow people to build on what you've done. And often, successful standards not only solve the problem that you set out to solve, but they end up solving a lot more. And once again, I hold HTTP up as the example for that. So that's pretty much what I had. And hopefully, I've not made more enemies than I already have by saying what I said about failed standards.
Give slides one more try. Sorry. Oh, and questions, yes, sorry. Were there any questions?
Yeah, I get more time at the mic. Maybe there are other questions.
No? Okay, let's give Debbie Dahl her due.
Okay, I'm going to talk about the multimodal applications that we're developing, or the multimodal standards that we're working on in the multimodal interaction working group. You can go forward. Okay, so the multimodal interaction working group is working on applications that will allow us to use the web in more than the traditional types of modalities. So traditionally we interact with the web with a keyboard and screen and mouse. We're adding voice interaction and pen interaction, so handwriting and stylus input, and other types of interaction like haptics, moving things around. So users can do lots of different things when they interact with people, and we want to bring some of those into much more natural and intuitive applications. We actually gave some multimodal demos a couple of years ago at the technical plenary, and this time we don't actually have time to do demos in this session, but the exciting thing about the applications that we're developing now are that they're starting to be based on the standards that are developed in the multimodal group and the voice browser group and other groups. So we're actually building very exciting multimodal applications based on standards. And this is an example of an application that we're kind of using as a reference application in the multimodal group. We call it t-shirt ordering. And this is one example of how you might do that. We have several different objects that you can order, a t-shirt or pants. They can be in different colors, and they could be different sizes. And you could say something like, I'd like a t-shirt in large in this color. So we would not only allow the user to interact with different modalities, but different modalities combined in the same input. So we can point at the same time as we're speaking and have that information be integrated and result in a t-shirt. The screenshot that we just showed was something that's already, the working group members have already implemented. This one is a little bit what might be the next step. So you could consider interacting with speech, GUI, and ink by circling what you're interested in and saying, I want this. And we find out that the user wants a green t-shirt in size medium using an ink input and speech integrating both of those. To kind of talk about a little bit the plumbing that underlies these types of applications, we have an example of the multimodal architecture instantiated with specific pieces that provide different functionality. So we have the interaction manager that controls all the coordination among the modalities and interaction with the user. We're doing most of our focus right now on using SCXML for that. The state machine language that's being developed by the voice browser group. We use DCCI for keeping track of user preferences and device properties. And then we have the different modalities. We have the speech interaction uses voice XML, SSML, SRGS, and SISR, all the voice browser application or standards. Pointing. InkML is being developed by the multimodal group, and then the keyboard and the haptics is kind of a promissory for some future interactions. And the all of the modality components cooperate by using what we call lifecycle events, and the user input is represented in Emma, which again is being developed by the multimodal group. How's the time? Okay. So this is just a quick summary of the points about the multimodal architecture. We feel it's a very powerful way for providing multimodal interaction. Some of the principles are that it's a very loosely coupled, event-based. It allows you to integrate multiple modalities into combine in an application. Modality components can be local or distributed. That's very important requirement for our group. Communication is event-based. We're using the standard lifecycle events that we've defined. Although components can expose other events as they need to, depending on the specifics of the application. We very strongly believe in this encapsulation of modality components being not visible to other modality components and trying to keep all the communication through the interaction manager. And representing user inputs in a standard way, using the Emma language. Okay?
Thank you. Yep. If there's any questions, again, there's nobody queued up. So next up is Sarah.
I'll give you a warning in 2 minutes, okay? 3 minutes.
So, hello everybody. I'm Serge Harmon from Nokia. And Nokia is one of the investors in .mobi. So we invested in .mobi because we think that is one way to encourage people to access the internet with their mobile. And I would like to explain you why. So the idea of .mobi is very simple. I can actually explain it to my mother. I just tell her that, you know, if instead of this little .com at the end, you have .mobi, it means that it will work with a mobile. And what is amazing is that she understands it. So basically, .mobi is just a sign that service provider can use to indicate to end user that that is mobile friendly and you can try to access. So why a mobile friendly site? If you try to access BMW.com site, for example, with a good smartphone, with a good browser, the site will be rendered properly. But what you see doesn't make so much sense. It's the upper left corner of the site. If you access a BMW.mobi site, what you see makes sense for the user. And one important thing for the user experience is also time to download. So BMW.com site will take over a good GPRS connection about 45 seconds to download, which I would claim is almost not usable if you intend to browse it. Okay, if the .mobi site takes 7-8 seconds, which is not fantastic, but it is usable. On 3G, in good condition, BMW.com will take about 10 seconds. It's usable, but not fantastic, and if the network is congested, it might be quite hard. But also what is important is what is the value for the user compared to the cost. And most people in this world don't have a flat fee. I don't have data rate plan. And what people would pay for a front page like BMW.com is something between 50 cents to 3 euro. And I would claim that that's much more than the value they get out of it. .mobi site will be priced about 6-7 times cheaper just because it's a smaller site. And actually, the .mobi company is also very active in, I would say, helping the mobile-friendly internet. They are contributing to the work of the Mobile Web Initiative in W3C, but they are also helping to explain this work and make it clear to developers through their developer forum. In addition, they have there some very nice free tools, like something called Ready.mobi, which is a testing tool, which indicates if the website is friendly or not for mobile, what are the problems, how to fix it. It also shows it on emulators. Another very nice tool is Site.mobi, which is a do-it-yourself mobile website creation tool. It is aimed for Mr. Everybody, so that they can make the site for the grassroots creation. And Coming is a mobile device database, which will allow people to find out what are the device and what are the characteristics. So in conclusion, I would like to say that .mobi is just a name. A name are not about technologies, are about user understanding. And .mobi has a clear and simple role. It's about discoverability and predictability. Thank you. Any questions?
Sorry, any questions?
Steve Zillis, AB Chair. I own Zillis.net and Zillis.org. My son owns Zillis.com. Which of us gets to Zillis.mobi?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's a problem with a name in internet or a feature. So which one of you will own the .fr or other version of the site? So somebody just have to buy it and you own it. And in future, there will be much more top-level domain name coming from ICANN, if you heard last week's decision. So that is just how the internet is working.
Charles McCarthy, Neville Opera. If you put McAfee Neville into your favorite search engine, it probably doesn't matter if you can't spell it. There's only me. So I can already have mcafeeneville.net.com.org.mobi.tv. Slightly bigger mobile than the old kind of mobile I used to have last year. An even bigger mobile, but not quite as big as the mobile that's coming next year. That's a great domain because it's slightly cheaper. There's a technology stack that's been around for quite a long time based on HTML, CSS, simple stuff, that's designed to actually allow you to adapt your content to a device. It's not very hard to build a browser that says, well, hey, I'm a handheld, I've got a handheld style sheet. The style sheet just says, don't worry about this complicated stuff that was designed only to download to the very expensive devices that have good network connections. Download the thing that looks good on a mobile phone. So I can make my site look good, you know, on a browser with McAfee Neville. Just the one domain that I actually want to pay for. Why, you know, why do we need a whole set of different domains? We have browsers that can do this. Why aren't we saying, just make the browsers work?
Well, what I would say to what I would say is that we need to encourage people to use internet. And many people have never used internet from their mobile, or they have tried, and they tried randomly on .com site, and they got a bad experience. And in order to encourage people, we need to tell them in advance that something will work. So a lot of people who might use weather.com on their PC may never try to access it on their mobile because they know the site on their PC. They will think it's expensive, it will not work. Actually, weather.com has a mobile-friendly version of the site. So it would work, but the people just don't know it in advance. So we just have to tell people in advance, and that's the use of the .mobi name.
I think we're going to close the queue after the people who are in line are done.
Tim Berners-Lee,
keep your questions nice and short.
This is I realize this is a wonderful idea to help people see that it's important that websites should be accessible to be usable with mobile phones. And in fact, I think I'd like to register way.mobi so that people in that domain will know that this site is accessible as well as usable on a mobile phone. And also, of course, it's important that sites should be able to be used with multiple languages. So we could have a top-level site.lang, and also for sites which are do not have any pornography on them. You know, people have suggested XXX, but you could also have a sort of NXX, which means this is not pornographic. So we could have put your site at not NXX. .lang to show that it'll do multiple languages, and .way to show that it's accessible, and .mobi just to say that it works on a phone, or maybe it should be mobi.lang or .way, or maybe, but I'm sure for you could probably register all of these, because this would encourage people to use even more websites, and encourage people to use the internet even more.
Phil Archer, Family Online Safety Institute, nice and short and sweet. I agree with the previous two speakers on this. You could go on forever. My organization was associated with the .XXX application to a certain extent. We were only able to support it because what we made sure that it meant was that if you had a .XXX domain, no matter what your top-level domain was, you were compliant with something and you had metadata which told you all about it. If .mobi or .anything else meant that you were guaranteed to have some useful metadata, that'd be a start, and then metadata could say whatever you wanted to say.
Yeah, so the .mobi company is actually checking the compliance of the .mobi site with a crawler, so there is no metadata directly, but there is compliance checked. About the name, I think we should take name for what they are. They are something simple, and you use them to indicate what you want. You can use a .fr/mobi if you want to say that it's in France and it's mobile, or you can use fr/something.mobi. So they are just something convenient that you can use if you want.
Same story, Ambassetti from Boeing. I think maybe I'm saying the same thing as the previous speakers, but you know, what are we going to do? Rewrite all of our sites, have a duplicate set for mobile phones? It's just not scalable for us. They need to work in some other way, in their normal sense.
maybe I can say if you make the effort to make a mobile-friendly site. Just indicate it.
Okay, so let's have something uncontroversial. Spam is bad. Why is my keyboard not working? My laptop has just blown up here. Okay. I just press enter. Okay, so spam is bad. Okay.
Down arrow.
Spam is bad. Net spam is worse. Hello, I'm Phil Hambaker, and I'm going to talk to you about one type of spam, link spam. I've not got time to solve all spam. Unlike email spam, link spam is targeting search engines. Link spam isn't directed at the reader of the site, or one reader in my case. Is targeted at the search engines. And so the solution to link spam is simple. Just mark parts of your website that are directed at the user that are from the blogger as blogger comments, and mark the comments that are coming from external sources as such. And we can use RDFA for this. Very simple. The part in green is the part that was supplied by the blogger. The part in red is comments that shouldn't be indexed. Now, this is a simple solution. Only slight problem is that we've now thrown out all the comments. We've thrown out the baby with the bathwater. We'd like to keep some of the comments. And also, the day that we stop link spam, we're going to get blog spam that is targeted at the reader of the blog. So how are we going to deal with blog spam? Accountability, again, is how we're dealing with email spam. It's going to be how we deal with blog spam. So the first step in accountability, we need to know who is posting. So we have to have an authentication mechanism, and we can choose OpenID, SAML, whatever, doesn't matter. And then we use our RDFA markup again to mark, here's the part that's coming from the blogger, here are the comments, and here's who posted this comment, and here is how they were authenticated. And so now, as far as the search engine is concerned, all the parts in green are good. It can tell that this comment was posted by somebody responsible because of reputation engines that are talking about who is a good commenter and who isn't. Now, this has another interesting effect in that comments now become blogs. You can have a search for all the comments published by Phil Hambaker. And this has an interesting effect on the blogosphere, because today the difference between the blogosphere is it's a broadcast medium. And the blogger controls the discussion. Once you've got the ability for the commenter to become a first-class participant with a reputation, the story changes. So in summary, let's make link spam the smallpox of spam, the first type of spam that we eradicate. We can do it within weeks. All we need to do is to have the RDFA markup, put it into the blog templates, and have the link engines, the search engines, take notice of it. And I don't have time to go into the rest of the types of spam to eliminate. I describe how to do that in my book. Available from good bookstores, December 28th. Thank you.
All right, Jose, you're up. Looks like guiding.
My name is Jose Cantera, I'm with Telefonica, and I'm participating in the MWI and in the Ubiquitous Web Applications Working Groups, and I'm trying to explain you what are the challenges around mobile search. As you know, as you all
all know, the amount of content ready to be delivered to mobile devices is increasing, and as a result, users are needing to search over that large amount of contents. And now the web is starting to be perceived as the mechanism to access information anywhere, anytime. But if we think about what our user expectations about mobile search are, very different. Users, while they are mobile, first of all, they don't want to type a lot of things. They don't want to incur on trial and error mechanisms for finding the information they want. But also, and it's very important, they would like to get results that are accurate or are can be rendered or can be managed properly by the user agents or by the browsers or by the devices. So also there is a challenge because some users they don't want to get results that may make them incur in high costs while they are browsing. And also it's very important to take into account that location and time in certain situations are very important. So this is a challenge for search engines. What technological challenge from the user requirements we can face? First of all, we need user interfaces that leverage the testbot approach. So we need to recognize concept and not only words. And auto-complexion, for example, is something that has been developed by device manufacturers, but they don't deal with semantics. So we need to be capable of have semantic auto-complexion. And the other big challenge is how to provide search results that are not only relevant from the content point of view, but also from the delivery context point of view. And the challenge here is how to index the content by several criteria, not only from the popularity point of view that it is the page run or from the text point of view, but also from the geographical point of view, from how the content is ready to be delivered to a mobile device. And content is not, some of the content can be delivered to some mobile devices, but not to others. So that content should not appear when the user is browsing with a specific device. So these are very challenging points. And here there are in the W3 SAN standards that can be used to address some of the challenges, and also that are more in the research space, such as indexing and ranking, taking into account different criteria. So you need to come up with methods for combining different rankings and trying to find ranking functions that can combine the scores. And that's all.
Sorry about the technical problems. They seem to be sorted out better. Hopefully the next session will go a little smoother. Please note again that there is voting for the wildcard slot in the second session of Lightning Talks. The URI is in the info on the TP channel on IRC, and I'll also circulate it to people who need it if you come up and ask. Thanks.
Let's give a hand to everyone who gave a lightning talk.
Thanks to Matt, too, for filling in for Rotan.